Hello everyone, it's Dr. Albert Wu, and I am here again for our patient safety research introductory course. This is session 7. Session 7 out of 8, in fact. So we are sadly nearing the end of what I think so far has been an excellent course, and one which I think has gotten a little bit better over time, which is preferable to the alternative. I am recording on the Raft, on Doodle, and also on GoToMeeting at the same time. So if I am not looking at the camera at all times, for those of you on the Raft, or if I pause, it's because I'm trying to navigate two PCs at the same time, so please forgive me. Today, we are going to talk about a very important and practical topic, which is translating evidence into safer care. A little overview for today. We would like to provide understanding and strategies on how research findings can be translated into practice. Oh, I'm sorry about the small typo on the screen. We have now come to the final item on our research, patient safety research cycle. The first is measuring harm. The second is understanding causes. The third, identifying solutions. The fourth, evaluating impact. And finally, translating evidence into safer care. I do think that 3 and 4 and 5, to some extent, need to happen all at the same time. And I'm hoping that this diagram is getting familiar to you. So as usual, we'll begin with a short quiz. Question 1. In the IHI, Institute for Healthcare Improvement, Model for Improvement, what does PDSA stand for? Is it process, delivery, study, activation, plan, do, study, act, position, deploy, steady, aim, or patient, doctor, student, administrator? What does PDSA stand for? Question 2. In forming a quality improvement team, which of the following members necessarily need to be represented? Leaders of the healthcare organization, physicians, people with technical expertise with the clinical problem, day-to-day leaders of units, which need to be represented, and which does not necessarily need to be represented. My question is a little bit obscured by some of the screens on my screen. Anyway, which of the following does not necessarily need to be represented? Choose one. Question 3, after summarizing the evidence for effective interventions, what steps are necessary to translate evidence to safer care? 1, identifying barriers to implementing the intervention. 2, measuring performance. 3, ensuring all patients get the intervention, or D, all of the above. Question 4. What is true about identifying local barriers to implementing interventions? A. The intervention is part of a work process. B. It can be helpful to walk through the steps that would be necessary to implement the intervention. C. Compliance can be improved by targeting failure points in implementation. D, all of the above. Final question, The four E's of implementing an intervention include A, educate, estimate, eradicate, evaluate. B, estimate, educate, execute, eradicate. C, engage, educate, execute, evaluate. D, none of the above. I would have had another set of E's, but I ran out of words beginning with E. So if you think about these questions during the lecture, maybe it will help focus you a little bit on some of the key points that we want to cover. So I think you understand very well that despite the presence of good scientific evidence, it is difficult to get into practice all of the changes or any of the changes that improve safety. Knowledge translation needs to occur. This is a step which both in developed and developing countries is a problem. Knowledge translation often doesn't occur. When it does occur, and to occur, it needs to occur within systems of care. We're going to today discuss an integrated approach to translating evidence to practice. This integrated approach focuses on systems, which really are how we've organized our work, rather than on the care of individual patients. We need to understand systems. They require the engagement of local, and I would say, again, local interdisciplinary teams to assume ownership of the improvement project. They require creation of centralized support for the technical work to be done. You can't expect people on the ground to have all of the technical know-how and skills that are necessary. So the research team needs to provide these. We'd like to encourage local adaptation, however, of the intervention, because there are local barriers and local circumstances that need to be taken into account. And it's necessary to create a collaborative culture first within the local unit and then within the larger system in order for this to be able to happen. I'm going to discuss two models. The first is the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. This is a very influential think tank in Boston, led by Don Berwick. And this is their model for improvement. There are three questions to ask. One, what are we trying to accomplish? Setting aims. Two, how will we know that a change is an improvement? Because there are often changes, but are they an improvement? Three, what changes can we make that will result in improvements? And then, after asking those questions, the idea is to implement multiple sequential rapid cycle tests of interventions or improvements. And what you do is plan, do, study, act, and then repeat again. Plan what the intervention is, do it, study how it went, and then act again. So the first step before you sort of do any of this is to form the team. And effective quality improvement teams include members that represent three different kinds of expertise within an organization. One is overall leadership of the system, high-level leadership. And you do need to have buy-in of these people. Otherwise, workers know that top leaders aren't concerned, and they also, top leaders can also provide other kinds of support and make sure that things happen. You need technical expertise with the problem that you're trying to fix. It could be a problem with the lab. It could be a problem with radiology. it could be a problem with a clinical problem, and whoever the expert is, it could be a pharmacist, it could be a physician, it could be someone who runs the radiology department, that person should be included. And finally, you need someone who provides day-to-day leadership on the unit that you're intervening upon. There can be more than one individual on the team with each kind of expertise, and one person can actually have expertise in more than one area. You may have a hospital leader who is a radiologist, but all three areas should be represented in order to drive improvement successfully. Here's an example. This is a team, and the aim, question one, is to reduce adverse drug events on all medical and surgical units by 75% within the year, within 11 months. So the team might include the team leader, who's Dr. So-and-so, who is chair of the pharmacy and therapeutics committee and patient safety officer in the hospital, someone who has some leadership role in both drug use and patient safety in the hospital. Second member that needs to be represented, technical expert, and this is Dr. So-and-so, who is a clinical pharmacist, actually the director of clinical pharmacy. The third area to be represented, day-to-day leadership, and this is nurse thus and such, who is the manager of a medical surgical nursing unit. Other members of the team that might be important might be a risk manager, a quality improvement specialist, a staff nurse, a staff educator, information technology person. Those people can also be helpful to make sure the team knows what it's doing. So that first step, setting aims. These are just some examples of aims. One aim might be to reduce adverse drug events in critical care by 75% within 1 year. So this is the aim that the improvement project would have. Another, improve medication reconciliation at transition points by 75% within 1 year. So when the patient is moving from hospital to home, can you make sure that medications are reconciled carefully and accurately? Three, achieve greater than 95% compliance with on-time prophylactic antibiotic administration within 1 year. So a patient is going to have surgery. You want to make sure they get a prophylactic antibiotic on time. You want this to be the case in 95% of cases. So these are very specific aims, and it is important to have specific aims that you're intervening upon. An aim that is make safety better is too broad, too vague, and unlikely to be successful. So this is another model which looks a little bit similar to the IHI model, but in fact it is a model which presents a strategy for translating evidence to practice. This is from Peter Pronovost and colleagues, it has, again, three sort of steps. And then a fourth step, which is particularly important. So the first step is to summarize the evidence. The second step is to identify local barriers to implementation. The third is measuring performance. And the fourth is ensuring, making sure, that all patients actually receive the intervention. This whole problem, this whole process, should be viewed within the context of the larger healthcare system, within the culture of care that exists within the organization. And it's improvement to engage collaborative teams to execute these steps. So this is not unrelated to the IHI model, but this further elaborates a strategy for translating evidence to practice. A little more detail on these four steps. The first, is to summarize the evidence. And this is to summarize the evidence for interventions that exist to improve a specific outcome. That specific outcome that you have identified already, as we just discussed. Again, the intervention should be targeted to that outcome. An interdisciplinary team of researchers and clinicians should review the literature to identify interventions that have both the greatest demonstrated benefit and also the lowest barrier to use. Something, an intervention might have great benefit. It might be replace all prescribing in the hospital with a computerized system. However, this would be very expensive and might not be possible to do for most organizations right now. And then, finally, to agree on which of those interventions that you found, and not more than, say, 7, and then convert those interventions into behaviors. And we'll give an example of how that should be done. Second step, very important, identify local barriers to intervention, because there will be local barriers. The intervention is always part of a work process and has to fit into that process. So the question to ask might be, what is the context that will be part, what is the context that surrounds the work process you're interested in? A very clever thing to do and a smart thing to do is to walk through the steps of doing the intervention with a clinician and observe what's required of the clinician to implement the intervention. And then to see where do they, despite the fact that you've laid it out and you are watching them, where do they fail to follow all of the steps that are required? Where are the failure points? And then to think what could be done to improve compliance. We'll give an example in a minute. Very important to understand the context in which the intervention will be implemented. One thing to do is to ask all of the stakeholders at different levels of the system, nurses, maybe even patients, doctors, other practitioners, people who run units, people who run hospitals, why would it be easy or difficult for them to comply with these practices? Would it be possible? Could they do it? Or is it just not possible? You need to listen carefully and learn what individual staff may gain or lose if they implement the intervention. It may take too much time. They lose time. It's very important to measure performance in an ongoing way, because just because you're doing something doesn't mean that it is going to be done and doesn't mean that it's going to result in an improvement. So you need performance measures to evaluate, for example, a process. How often do patients actually receive the recommended treatment? Maybe a measure of outcome, whether patient outcomes actually improve. Do patients live longer, have fewer infections, for example? And outcome measures are the things that really matter. So if you have a good outcome measure, that's preferable, but only if it's possible. Teams should use quantitative measures to determine if a specific change, an intervention, actually leads to an improvement. And this involves conducting sequential, observable tests. You want to make sure you're measuring information over time. You don't necessarily need to do enough to publish a dissertation. You need to gather just enough data to learn whether or not it's working, and then you can try again. This again is the plan, do, study step of the PDSA cycle, plan, do, study, act. Small tests of significant changes, multiple cycles, accelerate the rate of improvement. The final and most complex stage is to ensure that all patients actually reliably receive the intervention. We talked a little bit about this last week. An intervention must fit each hospital's current system, including local culture and the resources available. And we like to think about four E's of ensuring patients receive an intervention. You want to engage, educate, execute, and evaluate. Let me talk about those. First of all, you want to engage providers. This is often a necessary step to get people to convince people that they should do what you're suggesting. One way is to share the real life stories of local patients. Someone was injured by a medication error. Someone was very disabled by a wound infection. These are things, thus, that you'd like to prevent. And I think that everyone understands that. They are just thinking about other things that they need to do. You can estimate the harm that might be attributed to omitting the intervention. So if you did not do the intervention, how many people would be harmed by wound infections? And it's best if you have some data from your hospital about the baseline, the usual rate of infections, so that you could quote this. Each unit should then be fed back the annual number of infections and patient deaths attributed to infections. And people can follow this. They'll hopefully be more interested in it and will act based on those numbers. So here's an example of how to engage your healthcare workers. You need to educate staff at all levels about the intervention and about the problem. You should, on the one hand, present or make available original scientific literature to support the proposed intervention, then even the most skeptical practitioners could be convinced. You also want to provide some concise summaries of this evidence, because not everyone is a scientist. If possible, you would like to convert the evidence into a checklist that people can use. The third step is executing the intervention. And one thing to do is to design and implement. One thing to do is to design an implementation toolkit. That toolkit should be based in part on barriers that you have identified to implementation. If you know there's going to be a problem, you can come up with a tool to help overcome that barrier. Executing this sort of toolkit of solutions is based on three principles for redesigning care: standardizing care processes, creating independent checks, checklists are one example, and learning from mistakes. So here's an example of going through the steps to implement evidence-based care. We already talked about this article in a previous lecture, but I'm going to go through some particular elements of the exercise to emphasize the steps that we just talked about in the improvement cycle. To translate evidence to practice, once again, we want to summarize the evidence, identify local barriers to the intervention, measure performance, and ensure all patients get the intervention. In this case, to summarize the evidence, the summary of the evidence wound up being a review of five best practices for preventing central line infection. The original review was much longer than this, but this was reduced to five best practices that are both effective and relatively easy to accomplish. One is to remove unnecessary intravenous lines. Take them out if you don't need them. only leave them in as long as you want, they're necessary. Second is good hand hygiene. The third is use of maximal barrier precautions, including full drapes. The fourth was using chlorhexidine for skin antisepsis. And this has been shown to be even more effective than using alcohol. And finally, avoiding the use of femoral lines because this is a dirtier insertion site. So I think this is an important example of how to identify and address local barriers. So in order to see how this would all work, the team observed clinicians putting in central lines into patients. The clinicians needed to gather the equipment essential for complying with those five steps, getting sterile gloves, getting drapes, getting the chlorhexidine, et cetera, and they would go running around in up to 8 different locations to find all the necessary pieces and only then insert the central line. This was such a hassle that it wasn't surprising that they sometimes skipped some of the steps. So to make compliance easier for clinicians, the team introduced a cart. It's very simple. They had a cart on wheels where all of the necessary supplies were located, and this was the central line cart, and it could be rolled up whenever you needed to put in a central line. This was based on local intelligence about barriers, and there was a solution that was identified to address that barrier. Another important barrier was more cultural. Nurses on units were reluctant to question or challenge doctors who did not follow the recommended practice. I'm sure this is true in organizations all over the world. Doctors don't want to get their head. Doctors are sometimes grumpy. Doctors did not like to be questioned by nurses in front of patients or other staff. They were embarrassed. It made them lose face. So nurses didn't want to get their heads bitten off. Doctors were resistant. In fact, when you asked them, the clinicians all agreed that the recommended practices were necessary and good, but cultural barriers prevented nurses from saying, wait, doctor, you haven't washed your hands. Wait, you forgot the chlorhexidine. Wait, here is a sterile drape that you can use to follow all of the necessary steps. To address these barriers, the solution was a little broader. The organization, each unit implemented the same comprehensive safety program that included methods to improve culture, improve teamwork, and improve communication. Among other things, they gave the nurses scripts of things to say. Doctor, I'm concerned that we haven't observed proper hand hygiene. Doctor, it's very important, isn't it, that we use chlorhexidine to clean the skin? And doctors were socialized so that they expected these things to happen. They were convinced that the team could work better to prevent mistakes from occurring. The program was a comprehensive unit-based safety program, or CUSP, which was developed at Johns Hopkins with 6 steps. And this was addressed at a whole institution, a whole hospital, a safety culture assessment, particularly on the unit that was getting into the intervention, training for the science of safety for staff, asking staff to identify hazards in their own environment. What are things that you think are dangerous? Getting senior leaders to partner and even adopt units so that they would look in and watch over to make sure things were happening. These were now their units. And learning from safety defects and developing and applying tools to improve performance at those failure points, as I just mentioned, and then reassessing safety culture to see if people's attitudes to safety are changing. Are people more willing to speak up? Are they more willing to be interrupted in the name of safety? ICUs also did a few more things. implemented a daily goals sheet to say, okay, what are our goals for this patient today? We want to try to get them off the ventilator. We're going to take out their central line if that is possible. An intervention to reduce the incidence of other kinds of infection, ventilator-associated pneumonia, so people were thinking more about infections in general, and this unit-based safety program. They needed a measure of performance, and in this case, they chose infection rate, which is an outcome measure. First, because CDC, the Centers for Disease Control in the U.S., provides a standardized, scientifically rigorous set of definitions for what an infection is. And second, because the hospitals they were intervening on already were collecting data on infections. Now, they needed to improve that data collection in some cases, but they were already starting somewhere. Also, when they tried, it was difficult to develop a valid and feasible measure of compliance with process, compliance with the evidence-based practice of central line insertion, because lines were placed in different places in the hospital at different times by different people, and you couldn't always run over with an independent observer to see whether or not the process was followed. So even if this would have been ideal, direct observation of all insertions, it really couldn't be done. If you ask people to estimate their own performance, they'd be likely to overestimate a little bit. They tend to think they did better than perhaps they actually did, so this wasn't a reliable way of measuring either. I'm sorry, not a valid way. Those four E's, engage, educate, execute, evaluate, to make sure everyone is getting the intervention, these are crucial. We talked about engaging healthcare workers. So I'm going to move to the second step. We also talked about educating them about the science of safety, about interventions. The third step, to execute the intervention in a way that overcomes barriers. What they did in this case was they converted those five evidence-based behaviors, those five best practices, into a checklist. Because the best practices were not, for those, you couldn't go directly to check off, okay, I did all the things necessary. So they did a small translation, and the questions they asked were, before the procedure, did the healthcare worker, did the physician wash hands, sterilize the procedure site with chlorhexidine, drape the entire patient in sterile fashion? Washed hands? Check. Sterilized with chlorhexidine? Check. Draped? Check. During the procedure, did they use sterile gloves, mask, and gown? Check. Maintain a sterile field throughout? Check. Did all personnel assisting with procedures follow the precautions too? For example, did they wash their hands? Check. If you could check off all of these boxes, then this would assure that you executed all five steps and would help enforce adherence to the process. Finally, they evaluated the rate of bloodstream infections per unit. And this is for one unit, the rate of infections per 1,000 catheter days. And as you can see, the rate started at maybe 20 per catheter day. It went down a little bit, but then went up again. This is the point at which staff were educated. This was the point at which the line cart was introduced, and both of these steps seemed to first drive the rate down and then further. It stayed down but did not go to zero. It came back up a little bit, at which point a checklist that we just described was implemented, and this was helpful in getting the rate down to zero, where it stayed, and it, in many units, it is still at zero. It's helpful to feedback this information, so every organization were told what their own rates were, and shown every quarter what their rates were. In fact, the pink line going below that blue dotted line shows that the rate had dropped below the pooled average for all hospitals in the U.S. that were collecting data. So a to-do list for translating evidence to safer care. One, establish the team that's going to be doing the improvements, include an executive as well as experts. Pick a very specific area and also pick an outcome that you're going to be able to measure. Measure performance, implement the intervention. You should establish a protocol, figure out ways to check independently, and figure out where you're likely to fail and come up with solutions ahead of time to overcoming those failure modes. And then finally, document improvements and feed them back. I'm going to give a second example just briefly, and this is related to WHO patient safety's second safety challenge, which is called Safe Surgery Saves Lives. I'm sure many of you are aware of this. The challenge is based on the following problem. There are at least 200 million surgeries performed annually, with death rates ranging from 0.4 to up almost 1%, and complication rates ranging from 3 to 16%, even more in some hospitals and countries. There are at least a million deaths due to surgery and 7 million disabling complications. Surgery is obviously not safe, and this is a global problem. The Safe Surgery Saves Lives project had 10 objectives, including making sure the correct patient got the right surgery at the right place, preventing harm from anesthesia, being ready for airway emergencies and preventing airway emergencies, or making sure they're handled well, making sure that high blood loss is handled well, avoiding allergies, minimizing surgical infections, preventing retained instruments and sponges, making sure that specimens were obtained properly and were identified, communicating critical information properly, and establishing surveillance of results. This is the first version of the Safe Surgery Checklist. I'm sure that many of you are familiar with this, and it included things to make sure about before the surgery, during the surgery, and after the surgery. For example, making sure for signing in, making sure that you confirm the patient's identity. Is that done? Do you know what sites? What procedure is being done? Is consent signed? Check. During the surgery or at the time of the surgery, making sure everyone knows who is working and what is being done. Check. After the surgery, for example, is the specimen properly labeled before it goes off to the lab? Check. Now, in a minute, I'm going to ask you to think about the Safe Surgery Checklist and think about local barriers. But let me wind up with my formal remarks. In summary, in order to translate evidence to practice, we need to understand the context that the intervention is occurring in. What is the evidence for successful interventions? We need to change culture. We need to measure well. We need to evaluate how we're doing and feed this back to healthcare workers. I should say that sustainability is also important, and this is why continuous evaluation and feedback is important. Here are some references. A paper from Grawl and colleagues about effective implementation of changes. A paper from Atul Gawande's Safe Surgery, Save Lives study group on the surgical checklist. A paper from Didier Pitet and the first challenge of WHO, the first global patient safety challenge on hand hygiene and recommendations for implementing this, and the paper, a paper from Peter Pronovost and colleagues on translating evidence into practice, that model that we showed for knowledge translation. And finally, many of my bits of information on the IHI model were taken from the IHI website, and here is their web address. So we're coming back to the quiz, and I hope you've had a chance to think about this a little bit. Let's go through it. In the IHI model for improvement, what does PDSA stand for? Well, in fact, it stands for plan, do, study, and act. In forming a quality improvement team, which of the following members does not necessarily need to be represented? You do need leaders. Physicians can be on the team, but are not absolutely necessary. So that is the correct answer. Technical expertise with the problem, yes. And day-to-day leadership of units need to be represented, yes. After summarizing the evidence for effective interventions, what steps are necessary to translate evidence to safer care? Identifying local barriers to implementing the intervention, yes. Measuring performance, yes. Ensuring all patients get the intervention? Absolutely. So the answer is D, all of the above. Question 4, what is true about identifying local barriers to implementing interventions? Intervention is part of a work process. Absolutely. The intervention is to try to improve the process, in fact. So yes, it can be helpful to walk through the steps to implement the intervention. Absolutely, and you can identify that way failure points or barriers. Yes. Compliance can be improved by targeting failure points. Oh, I just said that. Yes. So D, all of the above. The 4 E's of implementing an intervention include engage, educate, execute, and evaluate. So the answer is C. So what we're going to do now is I would invite you to message in, to send in a question identifying local barriers in your organization to implementing the safe surgery guidelines. Why is it that it might be difficult for you to implement these guidelines in your organization? Now let me go back for just 1 second and I'll read these to you again. So at sign in, patient has confirmed identity, site procedure consent. The site has been marked that's going to be operated on. The anesthesia safety check has been completed. For example, does the patient have a difficult airway? Oh, does the a pulse oximeter is on the patient and is working, so you can monitor oxygen. Does the patient have a known allergy? Does the patient have a difficult airway, or are they at high risk for aspirating? Is there a high risk for greater than 500 ml blood loss? And does, if so, does the patient have adequate IV access? Are there fluids planned to be administered? Before incision, after induction, have all team members introduced themselves and said what they're doing? Have the surgeon, anesthesia professional, and nurse verbally confirmed the patient, the site, the procedure to be done so everyone knows? Have they anticipated critical events? Has the surgeon reviewed what are the critical or unexpected steps, operational duration, duration of operation, estimated blood loss? Anesthesia has reviewed, are there any patient-specific concerns? Nursing team has reviewed, has sterility been established and confirmed? Are there equipment issues or problems? Has antibiotic prophylaxis been given within the last hour? Are essential x-rays displayed? And at the sign out, has the nurse verbally confirmed the name of the procedure that was done, the instrument and sponge count, if the specimen is labeled properly, whether there are any equipment problems that occurred that need to be addressed, Have the surgeon, anesthesia professional, nurse reviewed any issues and problems that might occur for recovery and management after the patient goes out of the OR? So I'd like you to be messaging in what sort of barriers might exist in your organization. We will comment. I will try to comment on those local barriers. And if you have other questions, I will also try to take these. And I think what we should do, Mai, is we should now go to your screen and you can begin to collect some of those pieces of information from those of you who are in attendance. So we're going to pause for just a minute at this transition, and then we will go over all of these issues. So we already have a few points. The first is a question from Anantha, and the question is, what is there for a healthcare worker who champions patient safety? And I'm not 100% sure of what this question is asking. Maybe the question is asking what opportunities there are or what are the rewards for this person. I think that patient safety is something that is relatively easy to understand. No one is willing to say, I'm against safety. So I think it's possible for that healthcare worker to become identified as someone who is a leader in improving care, and I think that that can be a valuable thing in an organization. Perhaps that is a response to Anantha's question. Idelina says, surgeons not wanting to wait to take the time to mark the site or to respond to the checklist. Well, this is a problem in the East and in the West, absolutely. And I think what needs to be done is, this is part of the education process, among other things, that wherever this has been tried, and this has been including some of the best hospitals in the US and in England, as well as in developing countries, that in fact, even though the surgeons thought they were doing all of those things, there were very frequently cases where they were not following the checklist. Also, when the checklist was followed, the patients had better outcomes, fewer infections, there were even fewer deaths when the checklist was followed. This sort of information can help persuade surgeons that maybe it's worth the time. In addition, it seems like doing those things saves time. If suddenly in the middle of the procedure someone says, wait a second, I need a piece of equipment and it's not in the operating room, that's going to cause a delay. How long does it take to say, do we have the equipment? Check. That's much more efficient than suddenly realizing you don't have some equipment. So Trisasi says, some local barriers, low awareness of patient safety, and a supervisor not available on site. Well, I think that those are very important. I think that low awareness can be addressed in part by an engagement campaign and education, particularly of surgical staff. But this is always a problem. This is a problem everywhere. Part of the benefit of doing this is by increasing awareness of patient safety. In general, you increase awareness in surgery, and you increase awareness in infection control. So you can, with one intervention, you can benefit several areas. Supervisors may not be available on site. That is often the case, but the way this can be implemented at a local unit is that someone can be designated. It can be a surgeon, it can be a nurse, it can be an anesthesiologist, who is in charge of seeing that the checklist is completed before surgeries. A top leader can also make clear that they expect that all surgery in the hospital will be completed with a checklist. Recently, in England, in the whole country, it was stated that it is national policy that surgery will be preceded by, all surgery will be preceded by completion of the checklist. This sort of from the top down directive from a leader can help people understand, well, maybe this is a priority. Surgeons are the first barrier to implementation, sadly. The second barrier is ignorance. The third is an uncoordinated team or absence of teamwork. Mahuina, that is, I think we've talked a little bit about surgeons as a barrier and ignorance. When we're talking about uncoordinated team, I think things that can be done are teamwork training. This is part of an educational process. Part of that training is simply to give people structured ways of communicating. For example, nurses are sometimes afraid of speaking up because they are, as I said, they're afraid of getting criticized. Structuring communication in so that people say, for example, people understand that there's a code. If you say, "I am concerned," people should be concerned. If people say, "I am uncomfortable with what's happening," or people say, "I think this is there's a safety issue that is about to occur." There's an acronym for that, which is CUS, C-U-S. And those structured ways of communicating can be helpful. Also, checking back when someone gives an order, the person always says, if someone says, please start a large bore in central line. Someone says, getting central line, placing central line, so that people know what is happening. If you structure communication and show people how to do this, they'll begin to use the tools. So let's see, what's our next question? Nora says we don't have an oximeter. I think this is a huge problem, particularly in the developing world. There is actually a whole effort, which is part of Safe Surgery Saves Lives, to develop a market for affordable pulse oximeters that can be used in developing countries that are not too expensive, but also for which there is a network of repair technologists. And this is a goal, in fact, of WHO patient safety. This is obviously a very big problem. Zaza says the main barrier is culture and commitment of process owners. As if the surgeon is not willing to implement this, it is difficult to be implemented. I think this is true. I think that the difficulty is to convince that person, and this can be done in different ways. I think that in some ways that leadership from the top of the organization is important. In the other way, campaigns in which, for example, countries, ministers of health, sign pledges that this is something that's important. Hospitals sign pledges. There are campaigns that Safe Surgery Saves Lives, and posters are posted around an organization. This can help convince a surgeon that this is important. The next point, I apologize for the ambulance in the background. Helena is saying, how do you measure performance when translating evidence into practice for a particular pharmacologic treatment in terms of patient safety? So I'd have to think a little bit more about what the intervention was, but it might be that you want to increase safety in the use of a particular pharmacologic agent. It might be in using concentrated potassium. Improve the use of potassium, there may be a few things. There may be a policy for its use. There may be a change in how it is dispensed to the floors or to the units. It may be that there are guidelines for its use. And you can monitor all of those things. You can see, is there a policy? You can directly observe practice to see if people are using it properly. You can monitor whether or not all concentrated potassium has been removed from units. All of these things are measures. And if you look back at last week's lecture, we talked a little bit about these things too, how to develop measures. Naranga said, there's a lack of needed staff, nurses and attendants, and other minor staff. You know, of course, this is a problem, and there is not an easy solution to this at all. But in fact, if teams work more efficiently and more effectively, then this can make up in part for the need for staff. If things go better, if operations are shorter, then in fact you may not need so many personnel. If there are fewer complications, you might not need so many personnel. So in some ways, sometimes implementing some of these steps can make the process better, can make things run more efficiently, can even save money and improve outcomes. So Javi Bola says, I think the main barrier in my context is the time for running these checklists. Surgeons and staff are very busy. There's a trade-off. Absolutely. I think the selling point here would be to measure how long it takes to use the checklist, and then to demonstrate, perhaps in just a few cases, examples of where this actually saves time. As I said, if everyone knows what is going to happen and what the plan is, then things actually often go better. Someone may decide that they need a piece of equipment. If everyone didn't realize, if only the surgeon realized that piece of equipment was necessary, then there's a problem. If the surgeon suddenly wants a pathologist to do a frozen section of a specimen and the pathologist wasn't there, there could be a big delay. I understand that surgeons don't like to be in the room before anesthesia begins. And this is a habit. This is the way that people are accustomed to work. I think that part of what all of this is to change the culture. We do need to convince people that this is really a good example, because there's a trade-off. The surgeons are used to doing something in a certain way. They have more time. They have more time to themselves if they don't have to go in until it's time to make the incision. So they lose time by implementing the procedure. However, as I said earlier, if things go better, or if things actually run quicker, then they may actually, in the end, have more time. So they don't necessarily lose time, even though they do need to be in the operating room before the procedure. Asnat says another problem is that there will be a legal doc. There may be a legal document in the OR who runs the checklist. There's a couple of points in this question, I think is this a legal document? Well, I suppose it is. On the other hand, it perhaps can be a defense too. Look, I did everything that I was supposed to. The fact that there was a bad outcome is not necessarily, not necessarily the fault of the team. I think that in many ORs there is a good record of what happens anyway. So my lawyer friends say anything that really bad happens will come out in depositions. Don't worry about record keeping. You should keep records as well as you possibly can. I think that nurses don't get enough respect in many places, and this is a problem even more in developing countries. Absolutely a problem in the way this can empower nurses, however. OR nurses in particular are very important people. They have important roles to play, and if people understand that these people are not physicians, but they do have they're important members of the team, and they can help improve safety and improve outcomes, I think everyone can benefit from this. Himani says, some local barriers, lack of knowledge about patient safety, about checklists, reluctance on behavior part of doctors, since they've been doing things in a certain way. I think that we've sort of talked about this already. People do have habits, and the trick is to try to change culture. So we have a comment from Zara about concerns for recovery and management of patients at sign-out. time pressures on theater, can reduce implementation of sign-outs. You know, I think that one thing to do is to look at all of these procedures, to trial them in your operating rooms, and to see how to make things happen most efficiently. I think that, in fact, there is, if you go to the Safe Surgery Saves Lives pages, there are guidelines on how to adapt Safe Surgery checklist to your own context. And so I think the trick is to look at the guidelines and see what can we do, how can we make these work, how can we make them acceptable. Another thing to do is to engage in that process with leading surgeons to say, look, we know that surgery is not as safe in our organization as it could be. We would like to improve safety. This is a tool that we can use. It's been shown to improve safety. What do you think we can do to implement this in our hospital so that it works? We have time constraints. We have problems. Surgeons have habits. How can we do this so that it works and it helps us improve safety? Shiva Ganesh says, talking about patient safety can affect the quality of work by the staff. Is this statement acceptable? You know, I think that it can improve, even in a resource-poor setting, safety can be improved. Oh, the quantity of work by staff. You know, I think that this is a problem. In some cases, conducting safety interventions can slow down the course of care. It can cause some delays. And I think this needs to be studied. I think you need to see whether or not interventions work and how they can be fit into the processes that already exist. Just because something works well in Michigan does not mean it's going to work well in your context. But some things, in fact, might work better. Juan says, in a private clinic in Peru, we had many difficulties at the beginning, but we convinced surgery staff to bring the team to OR every day and use the checklist for 3 months. And after 3 months, in fact, in many of the hospitals where we implemented the checklist, even though the project was over, the staff insisted that they continue to use the checklist because it made their work better. People had a better idea of what was going on. They felt it made care safer. And people began to demand the checklist, even though they protested in the beginning. So Juan, that is a very important question. David says, one of the barriers in my setting is a lack of adequately trained specialists in surgery. We have health facilities in some centers with very good equipment, but no specialists. Patients lose their lives because they need to be referred to distant tertiary centers. I think government commitments of ensuring adequate safe specialists is important. David, I have to agree with you. This is perhaps a measure that can only be undertaken at a ministerial level or at a provincial level. And if a province or a country is insisting or is recommending the safe surgery checklist, maybe they need to commit to making other steps too. I cannot argue with that. I think you're absolutely right. David says also, do you think more international workshops will improve worldwide awareness? I think that they absolutely can. I think both international workshops and local workshops can help convince people. Often people are convinced more when a outside expert says something than when a local expert says something. This is just a fact of life, this can be helpful. These things can be organized at the regional level. WHO has tried to organize some of these things at a sort of an international level, though WHO itself has limited resources to do this. It's not possible to run workshops in all countries, all nation states in WHO. So Juan says, a key factor for success was disseminating patient safety as an institutional priority and working 1 year before the start to show what the financial impact was and what the problems were. So this is absolutely what I was talking about, Juan. We were talking about engaging local healthcare workers, and the best way to do that is with local examples. If you can see that your patients in your community are suffering because of these problems, well, that will convince people that they need to do something. So, Juan, we addressed your question there already. Raja says, I believe poor communication is very important. I think we talked about this a little bit. Are there any studies about heuristic pathways for medical competence in learning in relation to patient safety because of the time consumed or checklist or writing complete notes? They're frequent complaints. So, Mahuina, there is a lot of literature on human factors that are involved in patient safety. It's absolutely true that every intervention disrupts care in some ways, even if it improves it in the short term or in the long term. And, you know, so I think that everything needs to be examined in the local context before it is adopted, and things will be accepted better and will work better if you do this. You can't simply take something off the shelf and start using it. It needs to work in your organization. And you need to start with something that you think is very important and focus on that one thing. It's difficult to do everything all at once. So Naranga says, basically, the barriers are the same for all places. This checklist could help, and I think it absolutely could do. There are more questions posed. They will be emailed to me. I will respond to them and send them around again. We've again come to the end of our time. I think the hour went very quickly. I think that we had a minimum of technical problems today. I'd like to thank Mai Fuji and the staff at HOOG and at WHO Patient Safety for helping this run so smoothly. So I look forward to our last session next Wednesday at this time. I thought the comments were very good. I'm glad we had a good discussion. And I would like to thank you all, and we'll sign off now. Thank you all very much, and bye-bye until next week. Bye-bye.